We were talking before the meeting here, and I tell you, alcoholics, we like to travel and we like to eat. So I found some new places to eat, you know where the good sushi place is down there. And so with that, please join me in welcoming our main speaker from Port Hueneme, Cheryl G.
Good evening, everybody. I am Cheryl, and I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here in the presence of a loving creator and a fellowship that I am deeply indebted to, and thank you for that. I just got to catch my breath for a second. My sobriety date is September 28th, 1984. Just a few days ago, I celebrated 39 years of sobriety. And I have to say that I probably work just about as hard as I did on my recovery and my sobriety as I did when I was new. And I believe that that's a lot of the reason why I'm still here. I want to thank Tara for coming up and sharing the ride with me and being my my partner in crime tonight. I appreciate you being here. And thank you to all my friends who came up and said hello. My best friend Sal back in the back, thank you for being here. It's great to see all of your faces and to join you on this journey. I started out very young. I started drinking when I was 3, and just kidding. And actually, I was pretty young. I was about 8 years old when I started drinking, and I drank out of curiosity. I drank because other people did and they looked like they were having a good time and I thought that looked fun and so I wanted to try it and I did. I didn't know that I was an alcoholic, obviously. I didn't know that I had a allergy to alcohol that might turn me into something I didn't want to be. But my curiosity got the best of me, and the more that I drank, the more that I liked it. And by the time I was about 10, I was sneaking beer out of the garage refrigerator, and by the time I was 12, I was an alcoholic drinking daily. Consequences started to pile up in sort of this, as you can imagine, blurred way, because I was a teenager drinking, and I was causing trouble, and I was having trouble at home, and having trouble in school, and having trouble with friends, and having trouble with my parents, and you know, I just looked like a radical teenager. It was just a little bit out of control, right? Just a little bit out of control. And what nobody knew was that, you know, when I would go to school in junior high, I had a thing of vodka in my locker. None of my kids in school had vodka in their lockers. You know, they just didn't drink like me. I started doing a lot of things that alcoholics do, though. You know, I started to separate myself from people who didn't act the way I did. I started separating myself from people who didn't drink like I did, and I started to absolutely disown anybody who got in the way of my drinking. And I didn't know that that was alcoholic behavior. I didn't know that that was, I was fighting something that I didn't know how to control. I didn't know that I didn't have control. So my life has been filled with a lot of divine intervention, and my young life was about to be cut pretty short at a very young age, and I didn't realize that was the road that I was headed on. But, you know, I came from a good family. I was, you know, raised in a good home, and yeah, we had trouble, and there were things along the way that I wish hadn't happened, you know, but my family did do the best they could with what they had. And I know they didn't know that they were raising an alcoholic. But by the time I was about 14 years old, I had some family members who were getting into treatment at that time, back in the 80s. Young people's rehabs were becoming a thing. And they got into a young people's program and they zeroed in on me and said, "You've got a problem and you need to start going to these meetings." And I was like, "What in the world are they talking about, these meetings? What are they talking about?" And I asked my cousin, I said, "What do you do at these meetings?" And she said, "Well, we're sober." And I said, "Sober? What's sober? What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, we don't drink, you know." And I'm like, "You don't drink? What do you mean you don't drink?" And I mean, it just was the most absurd thing I'd ever heard. You know, I had never had any direct consequences to my drinking yet. And it was shortly after that that I got expelled from school for vodka being in my locker. It got, you know, the consequences started to build up. And they kept pushing and pushing. And finally, I started going to these meetings because I needed to get the heat off my back. I am 15 years old. I am aggravated. I am needing a drink badly. And I need these people to get off my back so I can get some space in between me and them and I can get on with my drink. So I go and I start attending these meetings and they say, well, you're not supposed to drink or do any other X, Y, and Z's while you're out here doing our meetings. And I was like, okay, well, you guys obviously have a real problem with doing that, but I won't. And so I started staying sober. I started staying sober out of sheer, you know, just defiance, basically. And I went to their meetings. I didn't identify. I didn't understand God. I didn't understand why you held hands. I just didn't get it. And my disconnect from people, you know, got worse and worse and worse as I continued to drink. And then in my short period of time trying to be sober, I found myself even more awkward than I was before when I was drinking. It was just a total mess. I mean, if you get sober, if you're an alcoholic and you get sober, there's a good chance that your life is going to get better. There's a good chance that things are going to start to solve themselves. Your problems are going to start to ease up a little bit. But eventually, if you're a real alcoholic and you have no solution, eventually you are going to either need a solution in recovery or you're going to need a drink. And so here I am. I've managed to stay sober for 6 months. I meet a few people that happen to be partying. I don't think that's a problem because I got this. I can do this. This isn't a big deal. I've got the heat off my back. Things are going better. I'm fine. And then I'm driving down the road one day and I'm hanging out with this kid and I went, oh my gosh, you know, if I was a real alcoholic, like those people say, I couldn't have stayed sober this long. I mean, I've been doing this for 6 months and I haven't drank once. I'm not one of them. This is crazy. I have given up all this really good party time. And it was within 10 minutes of that thought that I had a beer in one hand and a bong in the other. And I am a drinker that drinks with no off switch. So I don't plan when I'm going to start. I don't know when I'm going to stop. It's just how it goes for me. And so from that moment on, I was on and cracking again, and you know, there was no turning around. There was no going back. You know, forget the meetings, forget those people, forget going home, forget whatever my life had recovered to at that point was completely off the table because alcohol had become my master again. And so, you know, from that point forward, my life just spiraled and spiraled and spiraled and spiraled. At the end of that short period of time that I started drinking again, I went from living at home, being a good kid, going to school, having some friends, you know, life being fairly normal. And then within a matter of just a few months, I was living on the streets and eventually moved into this one bedroom apartment with five other guys and doing what girls like I do when they need a drink. I'm 15 years old. I can't even imagine what it would be like, you know, to have my children in the position, in the circumstances, with the people that I was in. I can't imagine dying out there by yourself with nobody to help you and nowhere to turn, you know, and suffering. But that's what my truth was. And so what happened was I woke up, I came to September 28, 1984. I walk into the bedroom of the place that I was staying at and the guys that I was living with were shooting up. And I knew, because this is the kind of alcoholic I am, I will put anything into my body that will make me feel differently. And alcohol is absolutely my drug of choice. But if it gets me there faster, it might work. And for whatever reason, in that moment, it scared me. In that moment, I was already weak. I was already 100 pounds soaking wet. I was sheet white. I hadn't eaten in a week, and it was messy. And I was dying. And, you know, I went into the bathroom, turned on the water, took a long look in that mirror, and I didn't recognize the person I saw anymore. And one more time, I reached out for help. And that call for help finally landed me in some place that could, you know, put me away for a little bit and get me dried out and maybe put me away a little bit longer and give me a little bit of a break from life as I knew it. And in doing that through rehab and in doing that going to a halfway house, I was able to stabilize some recovery and some sort of a willingness, some sort of an acknowledgement that I may be one of you. The seed was planted early. I'm really lucky. I don't want to shortchange the harm that I did, though, because in the short period of time that I was a full-blown alcoholic, I did a lot of damage. I hurt a lot of people, especially my family. I became a very cruel and cold human being that cared nothing, and I do mean nothing, about you. And I can relate to that person. I can see that person as she was the day that I walked in the door. But I can tell you that the person that stands here before you today does not resemble that. I do not live that, and I do not feel that. Alcoholics Anonymous has definitely created a miracle in me. So I got sent to a halfway house in Vegas, which I thought was a really good idea when I left the hospital because I really wanted to be out of the hospital. And my mother, who had been there and helped me through a lot of things, decided that she needed to fly with me over to Vegas because she wasn't sure I was going to get on the plane. And so we flew over to Vegas, and she gracefully delivered me to the people who were there to pick me up in their beautiful station wagon to take me off to a little place called Jeffrey House. And when I was en route, I was with a bunch of kids in the back seat, and I'm thinking about where we're going, and I see Vegas ahead, and I'm thinking, this is going to be great. I'm going to be in the lights of Vegas. I'm going to learn how to gamble. I'm going to have a great time. And we started to get further and further and further away from the lights of Vegas. And I said, what's going on? Where are we going? Well, we're going, you know, out to the ranch. And I'm like, what ranch? Where? I thought we were going. Nope. Oh, this was a bad idea. Oh my gosh, this is a bad idea. This isn't going to be any fun. I'm not going to enjoy myself at all. So then I start, you know, so then it's like back and forth, because the alcoholic mind will stay and it will pursue that drink until the end of your breath, until the end of your time. And I didn't know I was suffering from this, but this is what was going on. So it's a bad idea now, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of this? What am I going to do? And I look down at the ring that I had stole before I went into rehab. I'm like, this is a chunk of change right here. I could have a good time with this, you know? And I'm going, oh my gosh, but your mother just dropped you off on the plane, and oh my gosh, what are you going to do? How are you going to explain this to her? And da 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 da. But I'm going to come up with a great story, and it just goes on and on and on. I go, oh my God, you can't do this. You can't do this to her. So I take the ring and I chuck it out the window somewhere on the freeway in Vegas. And I said, oh my God, what did I just do? I just got rid of the only money I had. Now what am I going to do? I'm convinced one minute I'm not the next. I'm convinced one minute I'm not the next. I get to the ranch. It's a co-ed ranch. That might have some bonuses, but otherwise I really am not feeling this anymore. And I'm really thinking I would have much more fun in the lights of Vegas. And so I start to devise a plan because, you know, I'm resourceful. And so I said, okay, well, I got to figure out how to get out of here. And there was two modes of transportation. There was the station wagon, and there was a stable with a horse. And I didn't know how to hotwire a car, but I was pretty sure I could ride that horse. So I stayed up all night. I got my backpack in tow, and I walked out to the stable at daybreak to go saddle up that horse. And when I got out there, the horse was dead. And I don't think that God killed the horse for my benefit, but I do think that I got the message. And so I didn't have anywhere to go at that point. I had nowhere to get there, and so no way to get there. And so, you know, I ended up staying, and I stayed there for a few months. And then, you know, eventually I got kicked out and had to come back. And so my mom took me up to a little place that we had up north and kept me hidden away for a couple of weeks until she was sure she could bring me back to my playground and I wouldn't get in trouble. And I want to tell you again that if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you sit in our meetings and you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you sit in our meetings and you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you sit in our meetings and you do nothing, it might get a little better for a little while, but eventually it's going to start hurting. And that's exactly what I did because I didn't know how to do any different. And I came into the rooms and I sat and I listened. And I came in the rooms and I sat and I listened. And it got worse and worse and worse. My head got louder and louder and louder. And eventually I just said, I can't take it anymore. I can't be sober and I can't be alive. So I tried to kill myself. It was the only thing I could think to do. So I ended up in another institution and I ended up, you know, in another place that I couldn't control, in a mind that I couldn't control, and, you know, feelings and thoughts that I couldn't control. And I just absolutely wanted nothing but to be out of my skin. And in this institution, they don't look kindly to you getting loud, and they don't look kindly to you threatening behavior and things like that. And so I ended up in 5-point restraints, and all I could hear was the doctor saying, go get something or other, go get the straitjacket, go get this, go get that. And I'm sitting there with very, very heavy people just leaning all their weight on my body, and all I can hear is that relief is coming. Relief is coming. And in that moment, I had what we call that moment of clarity. And in that moment of clarity, I realized I'm about to get loaded again. And as soon as they put that in my body, it is over, because I ain't ever coming back to this. I don't want to ever suffer like this again. I would rather not feel anything than feel like this again. And that was a lie. And I knew it was a lie. And I knew if they shot me up that I probably wouldn't come back. And I knew that I needed to ask for help. And in that moment, I asked for help. I said, please don't shoot me up with that stuff. I'm an alcoholic and I won't ever be able to stay sober if you shoot me up. And those doctors, they let their hands off of me. And the doctor grabbed my face and he said, Cheryl, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started. And I reached out for help and I got a sponsor. And that sponsor led me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book, she said, Cheryl, there's a place for people like you and I, because we came here young and we didn't lose all the things that other people lost. We didn't lose the cars and the houses and the money and the things. Anything I had stole, you know? She said, but there's a place that's called They Stopped in Time. And it's about us alcoholics who have not gone as far as some of you have, but we don't have to have your story. And thank God I didn't. Because if I had gone out there and I had tried to prove those old timers who didn't think I was old enough to be there wrong, I'd probably be dead. And you have another speaker tonight. But I made my way, and my sponsor started to work me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she taught me about what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, that I was powerless and my life was unmanageable was obvious to me by this time. It was obvious. I had finally taken the bait. I had finally drank the Kool-Aid and said, yeah, I'm one of you. You know, it doesn't work. Step one does not work if you don't believe in both parts of step one. It just doesn't work. You can believe you're powerless, but not think your life is unmanageable. You know, you can see your life is a little unmanageable, but you still think you can control your drinking. You're going to have problems, you know. And I'm grateful for the sponsorship. I'm grateful that God led a woman into my life that I was willing to listen to and I was willing to take direction from. And I got through the steps, you know, in a short period of time. We didn't waste time doing them. I learned about the second step. I learned what it meant to be restored to a place of sane thinking when it came to drinking. That's step two. I didn't have a relationship with a power greater than myself. My power was God. My power was alcohol, and then it became God. You know, but in the beginning, God was a big word. And my sponsor said, "What do you believe in?" I said, "I don't know. The only thing I can tell you is that I believe that it works for you. And I believe in you, and I believe in your example, and that's all I can give you." And she said, "Then your group is your higher power for now." But she said, "It will change. I promise it will change." And it did. We got down on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And I didn't have any white lightning experience. I didn't have a big change of heart of any kind. I just basically said, "I'm willing. I'm willing to make this decision, and I'm willing to try to do something different with my life." And immediately after that, she said, "You're going to start writing your inventory now." I said, "Right now? We just did this step." And she said, "Yeah, right now." And I made that list of people that I was angry at, and it was a long list. And then, you know, I wrote about how it affected me, and I wrote about what my part was in all of that. And it was the first time ever in my fifth step that I actually got honest with another human being, ever. Never had I been honest with another human being. And I just have to say, because this is so crucial to me, it was so crucial to me that I could trust my sponsor, that I could trust that the things that I was sharing with her, my deepest, darkest secrets that I was sharing with her, that she would hold in confidence. And to this day, I believe she still does. If you ever have the honor and the privilege of listening to somebody's fifth step, please do not ever share that with another human being without their permission. It is the, yeah. In 6 and 7, she said, "Do you see these defects of character, the exact nature of your wrongs that have come out of this inventory that you've written?" Those were big words for me, and defects of character sounded like something we were going to fight about. I was like, I'm not sure about this. She says, "Well, you're not sure about being dishonest. You're not sure about stealing. You're not sure about maybe you were a little bit selfish when you did these things and you took from these people and whatever, whatever." Oh, it was the first time I'd ever even considered that I had some sort of character at all, you know? Now, it was on the bad side, and that didn't feel good, but she said, "You know, that will change, Cheryl." And I said, "I don't know, how does God take these things and remove them from me and all of this? I mean, I don't understand how this works." And she says, "You don't need to understand. You need to act as if. And from there, let God do the rest." So I was like, okay. So when I go to the meetings, I can't sit there and eye at your purses and see what you might have sticking out. And I can't look and see if your wallet's hanging out of your back pocket, because I was a thief. You know, I had to be a resourceful person when I was out there drinking. I trusted my sponsor, and I trust that this was working for you. And I kept going through the steps, and I started making that list of amends. And one of the top amends on my list was my stepdad. Now, my stepdad's been in my life since I was about 3 years old. And he's a good man. And he took on a lot, taking on the family that we were. And he provided a good home, and he provided structure, and he provided protection, all of which I barely appreciated ever. But when I was about 8 years old, I went to visit my real father. And during that time, during that visit, my real father had asked me, "Cheryl, do you love your dad?" And I said, "Which one?" Because I had two. I was raised with two fathers. And he said, "You only have one dad, and that's me. And that's the only dad that you're to love." And in that moment, something broke in me. Something broke in a way that was irreparable. I had been lied to. I had been deceived. And it was something that I just could not get over, and I could not forgive. And the day that I went home, that day when I went home, my stepdad, who had been so good to me and taken such good care of me, became my enemy. at 8 years old. Do you remember I said I started drinking around 8 years old? And I became cruel, and I hurt him, and I disrespected him, and I treated him poorly every day. And I looked at my sponsor and I said, I don't know how to make this right. And she said, well, let's just start slow. Why don't you, now mind you, we live under the same roof, and I wouldn't even speak to him. So she said, why don't you just go home tonight and say hello to him. Say hello to him when you walk in the door. So I went home that day, and I walked in the door, and he's sitting there in his easy chair, and I said, hello, Carl. He looked up at me, he says, hello? And that was it, that's all I said. But I kept practicing, acting as if, just like I had been told, act as if. And I went back the next day and I said hello, and pretty soon I would say goodbye. And the next thing you know, how was your day? And that developed into a really, really beautiful relationship. In about 3 years of my sobriety, him and I were sitting at the table and we were just having an everyday talk. And he said, do you know, today is a special day. I said, really? He said, yep. Today is our anniversary. I said, our anniversary? What do you mean? And he said, today is the day that you came home and said hello to me. Never underestimate the gravity of your amends. I never, ever could have imagined in a million years the man that he would turn into be for me. In his own right, a beautiful man, but to me, my hero. I've had loss in sobriety. My brother was one of us, and he tried for many years to get into this program and beat this thing, and he just couldn't. And eventually one day we got that phone call, and he had hung himself from a power plant in Las Vegas. And I felt guilty for a little while because I was one of you, and I had beat this thing, and I had gotten this thing, and things were better for me, and why couldn't I help him? And it wasn't my job. It wasn't my job. But I got to go on and make a living amends and to tell him it's been worth it in my life. And I'm going to keep going, and I'm going to keep doing this thing, not just for him, but for all the alcoholics who are still suffering. I don't know where God's going to use me. I don't know where God's going to place me. That's not my business. You know? I hate speaking, by the way. I hate doing this. This is not my thing. I'm not a circuit speaker, but you know what? I love showing up for whatever God has in store for me. I have a beautiful life. I've had some great experiences making amends, and they've all been worth it. Some of them have not been so fun. You know, some of them have been hard. It's hard to go up and swallow your pride and say, I was wrong. I stole from you. I broke you. I took from you. I took your respect and your pride and your dignity. You know, I was a horrible, horrible human being. But I showed up for every one of those amends, and the ones that I haven't been able to make yet, I am standing ready to make whenever God's ready for me to say it. 10, 11, and 12, I still call my maintenance steps. It's easy, but it's something that I practice every day. Every day I show up and I try to be a reflection of the thing that I've become, the person that I've become, the woman that I've become. I try to be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous by being of service and continuing to go to meetings and share with other people, especially the women, that this thing really does work. Service has been one of the greatest miracles of my recovery. When I did my steps through the first time with my sponsor, after I had gotten the relief that comes with doing your steps, it was like, great, so I've got this thing. Now I can just go to meetings and tell people how great I am because I did the steps, and you know, you should do them too if you haven't done them yet, you know, and what's your problem and whatever. And I did that for a good 10 years. Got married, had a couple of kids, got divorced, got married again, had another kid, fixed that, you know. And then I started working in a bar and started hanging out with a cocaine dealer. I mean, it's innocent, you know, no big deal. And next thing you know, we're hanging out a little bit more and a little bit more. And pretty soon I'm going on runs here and there. Still sober, haven't touched anything, working in a bar, but I haven't touched anything. I'm doing really good. And then one night it just hits me. He goes out to do his thing. And I said, you know, when he comes back, I'm going to tell him to line me up one right on the dash. There it was. I didn't even see it coming. I don't even know how I got there. How many meetings that I've been going to? I don't know. Not that many. When's the last time I talked to my sponsor? I don't know. A while ago, you know. And I realized the insanity had returned. And as soon as that hit me, he got back in the car. He said, you got to take me back right now. Right now. No more stops, nothing. Right now, I need to get back to where I was and I need to get away from here. And I ran to a meeting and I got honest. Right there in the meeting. I said, this is how I've been living my life and it's not working. And my sponsor said, Cheryl, who are you working with? Who are you helping in Alcoholics Anonymous? What are you doing to serve the program that saved your life? And the answer was nothing. The answer was nothing. And so another bout through the steps and got a little bit more clarity, and I was prepared to give it away, you know? And I started serving Alcoholics Anonymous, and the love of Alcoholics Anonymous just flooded my life in a beautiful, beautiful way. I never could imagine the magic that would have happened here in this, you know? But my soul truly, truly got renewed. And service has been my path ever since. Sponsorship, working in general service, working in our local community at district levels. I've done a lot of different types of service commitments and I've loved all of them. But sponsorship is truly at the heart of what I do today. I would love to tell you that, you know, through the 39 years that I've been here, that it's all been easy. It hasn't all been easy, but it's all been worth it. And all of the trials, all of the mistakes, I've done just about everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous that you can think of, and made a complete jerk out of myself, you know, many, many times, because don't you know I'm right and you should listen to me, right? And man, and what happens if we stay around here is we just keep getting humbled. And we keep getting humbled, and we keep getting humbled, if we allow it, right? If we allow it. And that's what I'm here to come back and receive. Just keep giving me that humility, because without you, I am nothing. Without you, I am not here. So I appreciate you letting me come and serve tonight. Please stay. Thank you. Yeah.
Have another round of applause.